Today's episode is sponsored in part by Modern Mammals, creators of a new hair washing product for men. You can help support Based on a True Story when you use the code BOATSPODCAST at modernmammals.com for 10% off. I've really been enjoying their shampoo light bar as an alternative to traditional shampoo. And I know it's in the name, but honestly, when I first used it, I was surprised at just how light and airy it feels. It reminds me of using a bar of soap for your hair, except it's even better than that because if you're like me, you don't like the residue that some actual bars of soap leave behind. And the shampoo light bar is easy to wash out without leaving any residue behind. Modern Mammals also focuses on creating products that help you keep your hair's natural oils so it's not left feeling poofy and frizzy. Go to modernmammals.com and use code BOATSPODCAST for 10% off. Again, that's modernmammals.com for 10% off with promo code BOATSPODCAST. Don't forget to use the promo code BOATSPODCAST so they know I sent you. Thanks, Modern Mammals. Okay, let's start today's episode. Hello, and welcome to Based on a True Story, the podcast that compares your favorite Hollywood movies with history. Today, we're going back to the 1941 film called They Died with Their Boots On, about the life and military career of General George Armstrong Custer. To help us separate fact from fiction in the movie, we'll be chatting with Professor Gregory J.W. Irwin from Temple University. Gregory is an author and historian who has written extensively about military history, including a book all about Custer called Custer Victorious, The Civil War Battles of General George Armstrong Custer. Before we connect with Gregory, though, let's set up our game, Two Truths and a Lie. If you're new to the show, here's how it works. I'm about to say three things. Two of them are true, and that means one of them is an all-out lie. Are you ready? Okay, here they are. Number one. Custer's promotion to general during the Civil War came as a surprise. Number two, Custer was not a model student at West Point. Number three, Custer commanded the 7th Cavalry during the Civil War. Got him? Okay, now as you're listening to our story today, your challenge is to find the two facts scattered somewhere throughout the episode, and by a simple process of elimination, you'll know which one is a lie. And of course, we'll do a recap at the end of the episode to see how well you did. All right, now it's time to chat with Gregory J.W. Irwin about the historical accuracy of They Died with Their Boots On. Let's start with an overall look at the movie. If you were to give this movie a letter grade on how well it told Custer's story, what would it get?
Well, if you were to ask that question to George Armstrong Custer, or better yet, his wife, Elizabeth Bacon Custer, who after his death became his chief PRA, they would say, hey, as a historian who's willing to give Hollywood a certain amount of leeway in dealing with the past, I give it a C, primarily because no other screen Custer has done a better job of capturing Custer's more attractive qualities than Errol Flynn, his charisma, his charm, his ability to ride a horse well. some movie Custers look like a sack of potatoes on the back of a horse. But there's an awful lot of telescoping because you're covering something like 19 years from 1857 to 1876. And there's an awful lot of fabrication too. A lot of facts get sacrificed to tell a fun story.
Well, we're accustomed to that with movies, but at least, you know, this one, it sounds like it captured his ability to ride a horse, at least what you would expect for the cavalry.
Exactly. Flynn Custer was a dashing person. He knew how to inspire men in combat, especially during the Civil War. And Flynn exudes that aura.
Well, you mentioned the date of 1857, and that is when the movie starts as Custer joins West Point. Can you give us an overview of George Custer's life leading up to the point at which we see him in the movie's timeline?
Sure. He was born in New Rumley, Ohio. That's a town near present-day Steuben. It's now in the middle of fracking country. on December 5th, 1839. He was the eldest child of a second marriage. His father, Emmanuel, was a widower, and his mother, Maria Ward Kirkpatrick, was a widow. He's born into a family already with a bunch of half-brothers and half-sisters, and then his parents, in addition to him, by sire, three other boys and a girl. Emmanuel is a blacksmith, which is a skilled job, but he's not very wealthy. He is best known for being something of a big mouth. He's an outspoken Jacksonian Democrat and likes to get into political debates at a time when politics were as rollicking and sometimes as vicious as our own day. After a half-sister marries a fellow living in the town of Monroe, Michigan, which was a prospering Lake Erie port, George, or Audie, as his family called him, they send him there because the schools are better. So they're looking to give him a better crack at life. So he gets a better education because he wasn't all that bookish, but he's exposed to some of the higher things in life that you wouldn't have found in New Rumley, Ohio.
Would that be an example of the phrase, you can lead a horse to water, but you can't make it drink? At least you're going to try to give him a good education, even if he's not that.
Yeah. Some of it rubbed off. The fact that he went to West Point indicates that he was looking to advance himself, because most Americans didn't go to college back then. The U.S. Military Academy was a good engineering school. So at the very least, even if you couldn't make a good career in the Army, you might be able to find work in a country that was moving now with a vengeance into the Industrial Revolution. There are two stories about how he got into West Point. One was that he developed a relationship with a young woman named Mary Holland, who came from the better side of town. And her father looked with alarm on this burgeoning relationship and wanted to get pest around in the neighborhood. So he put pressure on the local Republican Congressman, John A. Bingham, to get Custer an appointment to West Point. The other story is that Custer himself applied to Bingham, which probably sounds more likely. And in the second half of the 1850s, Republican Party is brand new. It's born in 1854, 1856. And it's pulling in a lot of different Northerners from diverse political backgrounds, people who are now angry at the South over the spread of slavery. And so you've got Democrats, and you've got Whigs, and you've got a political abolitionist joining this coalition. And Bingham may have thought, well, this is a way to get the Custer family into our coalition. So one way or the other, Custer gets that appointment to West Point, and that is a major turning point in his life, because it opens doors for him, and it opens his eyes to new possibilities about what he can make of his life.
I do like the story of just trying to get rid of him. And so to do that, we're going to send him, get him to go to West Point.
Stranger things can happen. Maybe both forces were at work.
Well, once he does get into West Point, according to the movie, we see there's a long list of delinquencies. One of the men actually remarks that Custer is going to make the worst, or have the worst record of any cadet at West Point since Ulysses S. Grant. And then, at least according to the movie, he fulfills that prediction of having a terrible record, but he still manages to graduate, even though he's the last of his class to graduate, and he's assigned to the 2nd Cavalry. How was Custer's time at West Point?
Well, that's a great question, and that is one part of the movie where they really adhere to historical accuracy, except for the slam on Grant. Grant graduated toward the center of his class. He wasn't a great student. He excelled mainly at horsemanship, but he wasn't in danger of ever flunking out. But Custer was, according to one of his schoolmates, he said he had more fun and caused his friends more anxiety than any other cadet I've ever known. That friend would later become a professor at West Point. So he knew a lot of cadets. Custer, you know, he wasn't dumb, but he told this same person, Peter Mickey, he said, there are only two places worth having in a class. Number one and the last. We're ready to go, you know? And he wasn't really that inclined to work all that hard to be number one. So he, according to Mickey, he tried to stay as close to the bottom as he could without being kicked out. Now, Custer would later say, well, you know, if the Civil War hadn't come along and if a lot of my Southern classmates hadn't resigned to join the Confederacy, my class standing would have been a lot better. At the same time, he said, my career at West Point, you know, I'm not a role model. Some generations should not follow. But he was a prankster. You know, he loved hazing underclassmen. He loved escapades. One time in Spanish class, and, you know, he plotted this with his classmates ahead of time. He asked the professor, how do you say class is dismissed in Spanish? And the professor said the words, and the cadets pulled, you know, something Custer planned. He was getting in trouble, but at the same time, the people who were the officers, the technical officers who were scoring him with demerits, they liked him. Because he said, you know, this is the kind of, because they knew his classmates liked him and they'd follow him in these hijinks. And they said, this is the kind of leadership capabilities we're looking for in young officers. Hopefully he'll mature. But, you know, he's got these tendencies. So at least once it looked like he exceeded the number of demerits that would have resulted in his automatic expulsion. But somebody went into his record book and erased a bunch of them. You know, and saved his bacon. But he graduates last, 34, in the class of June 1861, after the Civil War had broken out.
Was he not that interested in the schooling side of it, and more on the military side? Like you mentioned, Grant.
He was a good horseman. He was a people. He was a good swordsman. He read a bit. More often novels, romance novels about cavaliers from the Napoleonic Wars and things like that. But you know, he was kind of a class clown type of guy. You know, I would categorize him more like that. But he did just, you know, he would reach a point where it looked like he was going to be expelled for getting too many demerits, and he'd go weeks at a time without getting clipped. And the same thing with his studies. You know, he'd reach a point, oh, I got to get a better grade on this on the next exam. And he did what he could to stay in, but not to distinguish himself academically.
Yeah, he was self-aware. It sounds like he knew when he needed to hunker down and focus. Yeah.
Yeah. So afterwards, in later life, when he became a success writing magazine articles, wrote an autobiography. After he died, some of his classmates, when they wrote to his widow, they said, we never thought he was that smart. He could write a book.
Surprise.
Yeah. So just because someone doesn't get good grades doesn't mean that they are bound for failure in life. And a number of people who've been successful in the military didn't, you know, they weren't the top of the class academically, but they had other qualities like Dwight David Eisenhower that made them successful in a later life.
Yeah, I would say Eisenhower was rather successful in life. Well, you mentioned the date of 1861, and according to the movie, the first action in the Civil War that we see Custer taking part in is on July 21st, 1861 at Manassas. And almost immediately, he does something that he shouldn't do when he knocks down his commanding officer and orders his men to take a bridge. How well did the movie do showing Custer during the Manassas campaign?
It's exaggerated. The depiction of Custer at Bull Run is exaggerated. Now, you know, he graduates June 24th, 1861, he goes to New York, orders a uniform, buys a saber and a revolver and other officer equipment, heads down to Washington, and he's assigned to accompany the 2nd Cavalry, which is part of the army that's going to try to capture Richmond, which is going to march on Bull Run. It's his first battle, and his Civil War memoirs, which he was writing at the time of his death, he just, I was there and watched this and wondered if we got into action, if I should use a saber or a pistol. But he doesn't talk about knocking out a squadron command or performing any feats of daring do. Congressman Bingham, who got him into West Point, would later claim that when the Union forces were retreating, a wagon got upset on a bridge, and troops began panicking because they had visions of rebel cavalry coming down on top of them, and that Custer stepped in and restored order. And he may have done that, but punching out a superior officer on the battlefield, only in Hollywood could you get away.
I was going to say, there's demerits in West Point, but I think that might be something that you would not be able to come back from. Well, there is a scene in the movie where Major Romulus Tape is writing a letter to Custer to reprimand him. But then Lieutenant General Scott walks in, and upon the news that Confederate General Lee is near Gettysburg, Scott orders Tape to dictate a letter to appoint a new brigadier general to command the Michigan Brigade. And that letter gets written down on the... It's interesting the way the movie shows it. It gets written down on the paper that was originally addressed to Custer at top, where they're going to reprimand him. And then at the bottom in the letter is this, you're appointed to being a brigadier general. And the impression I got here was that it was both rushed, a mistake, and a complete surprise to Custer himself. Is that true?
Custer's promotion from first lieutenant to brigadier general at the end of June 1863 came as a surprise to most of the rest of the Army, and probably to him, but it wasn't an accident. After Bull Run, he's a West Pointer, and even a West Pointer with a poorly ingested military education, he's been trained to be a soldier for 4 years, and he's part of an army of amateurs, all these civilians who have been recruited. I mean, during the first year of the war, the Union Army went from 16,000 men to more than 600,000. So having officers with any kind of training, they were at premium. And so he starts getting assigned to various staff positions. And by the spring of 1862, he is assigned to the staff of the most powerful soldier in the Union Army, Major General George B. McClellan, who commands the Army of the Potomac. That was the North's largest field army. And McClellan loves Custer. He says, this guy, his head was always clear of danger, always brought me accurate reports. I could count on him for anything. And Custer, goes from being the goat of his class, the Charlie Brown of West Point, to someone sitting on the footstool at the center of power. And he's making connections. He's networking, as we'd say today. And the command, even though most officers aren't West Pointers, they're fresh from civilian life, the senior command, these are West Pointers, they look out for each other. And they look out for their younger associates. And McClellan, it's funny, Custer idolized him. He said he died for him. And this is an officer who was always looking for a fight. And he feels that way about a general specialized in avoiding fights. McClellan is extra cautious. But he serves with McClellan until McClellan's removed from command after Antietam in November 1862. And it looks like, I got to go back and serve as a platoon commander. But then another general, someone who's not as highly placed, Brigadier General Alfred Pleasanton, he commands a cavalry division. Yes, Custer to serve on his staff. And a few months later, Pleasanton becomes commander of all the Union cavalry in the Army of the Potomac, the cavalry corps. So he's more important, but he likes Custer too. It's kind of a father-son relationship. He finds Custer reliable. He can always trust him to bring him clear intelligence. Back then, They didn't have iPhones. If you wanted to give an order to the commander of a unit that was some distance away, you sent an aide, especially if you didn't have time to write down a long order. The aide, you had to count on him to remember clearly what you rattled at him, you know, in some application. And Custer was good at that. And Pleasanton, after he becomes commander of the Cavalry Corps, the way he got the job was he was something of a backstabber. Once he is in the position of power, he doesn't want anyone stabbing him in the back. So he starts replacing brigade commanders with people who are loyal to him. And George Armstrong Custer is part of that Pleasanton family. And Pleasanton, right after George Gordon Meade becomes commander of the Army of the Potomac in the middle of Lee's invasion of the North, Pleasanton says, I want to give this brigade to one of my aides, Custer. And Meade says, fine. And Custer gets a letter addressed to Brigadier General George Armstrong Custer, which, according to his first biographer, who spoke to Lippy extensively, that took him by surprise. But he was very happy to accept the appointment.
I like the way the movie showed it, where they were talking about General Custer, and he's there. He's like, you know, don't make fun of me. You know, don't call me General. Don't make fun of me. Like, he thought the people were mocking him there. But no, yeah, you're General Custer.
Supposedly, he boasted, you know, before this war's over, I'll be a major, or I'll be a general. So people were always joshing him, and he thought they were just you know, carrying on the joke. But that might have happened. Again, that's that a variation on that story is in his first biography that appeared a few months after the Little Big Horn. You know, as I say, he's the youngest general in the Union Army at that time. He was 23 years old. Some younger appointed later, but at that time, bam, and people say, Custer?
As I'm recording this right now, on the other side of my door is my cat. He's always wherever I am as I'm working on the podcast. He watches all the movies with me, and he lets me know when it's time to stop working by sitting on my keyboard. I love the little guy. And as a pet owner, that means there are expenses like vet bills that can pop up, and sometimes that's unexpected. That's why I was happy to learn about today's sponsor, EarnIn, because they can help make sure that I've got the money to cover those unexpected vet bills. EarnIn is an app that gives you access to your pay as you work, up to $100 per day or up to $750 per pay period. Now you can join over 3.5 million customers. Get the peace of mind that comes with EarnIn. Download EarnIn today, spelled E-A-R-N-I-N, in the Google Play or Apple App Store. When you download the EarnIn app, type in True Story under podcast when you sign up. It'll really help the show. True Story under podcast. EarnIn is a financial technology company, not a bank. Subject to your available earnings, daily max, pay period max, and location. See earnin.com/TOS for details. Bank products are issued by Evolve Bank and Trust, member FDIC. Thanks, EarnIn.
If we go back to the movie, almost immediately after he's given the command, General Custer then defies the order to go to Round Top, just south of Gettysburg. And then they hear some gunshots in the distance, and he orders his men to ride to the sound of the guns in the distance. Meanwhile, we find out that Jeb Stuart is attacking Hanover from a bit of paper that's dated, I think it was June 30th, 1863. And according to the movie, it kind of sets this up that all that stands between them and disaster is this Michigan brigade. And then at this point, General Tate realizes that Custer's the one that's been made general, and he's attacking Stuart at Hanover. And this seems like disaster because, you know, Custer, you know, with all the demerits that he had in at West Point. We don't see a lot of the fighting in the movie itself, but we do see different regiments charging, being repulsed until finally the 1st Michigan managed to break through and force Stuart to retreat. In the end, Custer is named the hero of Hanover. How well did the movie do showing Custer's first command after being made general there?
There's a tenuous connection to the truth in those scenes. When Robert E. Lee began his second invasion of the North, when he headed into Pennsylvania, landed up at Gettysburg, Jeb Stuart, his cavalry commander, cut loose with 3 brigades to ride around the Union Army. He had done this before, got him a lot of newspaper praise, But it was also a good way of demoralizing, harming their logistics, etc. So Lee tells Stuart, yeah, you can go on this raid, but don't be gone long, because Lee is moving enemy territory. And he depends on Stuart for his intelligence. He depends on Stuart to know where the enemy is, what the enemy's planning to do, where the enemy's headed. So Stuart goes up on this raid, and at first it goes well. He captures a big wagon train full of supplies and starts heading back to join Lee. But the Union Army has placed itself between Lee and Washington, D.C. So it means Stuart has to kind of circumvent the Union Army. And the Union cavalry is out doing what cavalry is supposed to do, looking for the enemy, reporting to headquarters. And the division Custer's in, the 3rd Cavalry Division, is doing that. And on June 30th, 1863, at a Pennsylvania town called Hanover, they bump into Stuart. Stuart bumps into them. They get in his way, and they fight a brisk firefight. And then Stuart kind of swings north around the cavalry, starts heading west to try to rendezvous with Lee. So the fight at Hanover, it's a minor affair. Stuart links up with Lee on the night of July 2nd. And the following day, Lee sends Stuart with 4 brigades to menace the right flank of the Union Army at Gettysburg. Custer's division had orders to move from the right flank to the left flank, to move south to Little Round Top. There were 2 brigades in Custer's division. The first had already moved out, and Custer's guys were encamped on the right flank, which was supposed to be guarded by the Union 2nd Cavalry Division under Brigadier General David Gregg. Well, just as Custer's getting ready to ship out, Jeb Stuart makes his appearance. And Gregg has 2 weak brigades. Stuart had 6,000 men. Gregg has something like 3,000 guys. And he says to Custer, stay here. I'll disobey your orders to report to the left. I'll take responsibility. Custer looks and says, that's where the enemy is. Yeah, I'll stay here. He had about 2,500 men in his brigade. So it's the biggest Union unit on the field. And Gregg puts him in the center. And then Stuart, there are all kinds of theories about what Stuart's intentions were, that he meant to outflank the Union Army and hit its rear in conjunction with Pickett's charge, which would also be staged on the afternoon of July 3rd, 1863. Or he was just there to, create some mischief, distract the Federals. But you have a pretty large-scale cavalry action. And Custer... he starts off and he sends out one of his regiments, which is armed with 7-shot Spencer repeating rifles. They're a novelty at this point, and skirmishers. They drive the rebels back. But the trouble with repeaters is that you burn off your ammunition quickly. And so they're out of ammunition, and the rebels start crowding them. And Custer puts himself in front of another regiment, the 7th Michigan, leads a charge, and drives the rebels back until they come over a rise and they slam into a stone wall with a rail fence on top of it. And the rebels are on the other side firing into the Federals, emptying saddles. So Custer has to retreat. And then about half of Stuart's force, maybe a little less than about 2,000 guys, come out mounted to fight their way through the Union center. Custer has 2 regiments now that have been dispersed. He has another one guarding his artillery. That leaves him just 1 smaller regiment, the 1st Michigan Cavalry, 500 men. And as the rebels come down, he says, well, there's nothing else to do. And he charges head on. In fact, just before his regiment makes contact with this rebel mass, he spurs his horse so that all the Union troopers can see him. And just before he disappears among the rebels, he yells, come on, you Wolverines, appealing to local pride. And they give a shout and follow him in, and they stymie the Confederates, the impetuosity at charge. By that time, some of Custer's other dispersed troopers have gotten to the horses, and they're hitting the rebels on the flanks. Some elements from one of Gregg's brigades hit the rebels on the flanks. And so it's like this freight train is coming down, and then it stops. and it wavers and the rebels end up melting away. And the Federals win the day. And they weren't used to forcing the Confederates to retreat. But Custer, you know, plays an important role in that. And that's the beginning of his rise to national hero status. His men are delighted. They say, wow, this is great. You know, this guy, I mean, it's just like, at first, they don't know who he is. This is how Dan West Porter put it. Then they're saying, anything he does, he succeeds. And we're so glad. During Lee's retreat from Gettysburg, on the last day, Custer leads his troops against Lee's rear guard, take a number of prisoners, and one fellow who's in his escort writes home, I saw General Custer plunge his saber in the belly of a rebel who's trying to kill him. You can guess how soldiers fight for such a general. Yeah. So he charms with his personal courage and the fact that he looks to be a winner. They like that too.
Well, you mentioned the charge, and the way the movie kind of portrays it, the impression I got was Custer was supposed to play more of a defensive role, but then he charges, and that's almost, again, seems to imply that he's not necessarily straight up breaking orders in this case. That was the impression I got, but more like just not, maybe not the best military strategy.
Well, yeah, the movie puts him in complete charge. There's no other federal troops there. He's serving under General Gregg. Initially, he's fighting defensively. He's got dismounted skirmishers. And then when that skirmish line gets in trouble, then he charges with the 7th Michigan. And then when the rebels, they come out to make a charge, then he will countercharge because he's got nothing else. It was the only regiment available. It was a gamble. I mean, it could have been Custer's last stand right there if the charge hadn't been successful. But it worked out. It worked out. Oh, yeah, the movie kind of fudges things.
The movie doesn't actually show a lot of General Custer's time during the Civil War. After this, we do see a montage of what I'm assuming. The movie doesn't really explain this, but what I'm assuming is these are the battles that Custer fought during the Civil War. There's text on the screen, you know, Monterey Gap, Yellow Tavern, Woodstock, Winchester, and Cedar Creek. And we see Lee surrendering and the end of the war. Can you share an overview of General Custer's campaigns during the Civil War?
After Gettysburg, as I mentioned, Custer is prominent in pursuing Lee's retreating army. And then in the rest of that summer, as the Union Army of the Potomac and the Confederate Army of Northern Virginia under Robert Lee maneuver against each other, the cavalry, you know, is between the infantry. And so Custer sees a lot of action, sparring with Jeb Stuart and other Confederate cavalry commanders. And he matures as a general. He becomes more versatile tactically and he increasingly improves his performance. That reputation he makes at Gettysburg gets burnished. In early 1864, there's a shakeup in the Army of the Potomac. A general from the West, Ulysses S. Grant, is made commanding general of all the Union armies, and he decides he's going to personally supervise the campaign against Lee. He gets rid of General Pleasanton, the commander of the Army of the Potomac's cavalry, and installs one of his pets, a general named Philip Sheridan, in command of cavalry. This is really the first time Custer meets Sheridan. Sheridan was in the class of 1853. He wasn't superintendent of the military academy. But he would have been the last guy to be superintendent of the military academy. He was a hot-blooded Irishman. And he got upset with a superior cadet, a Southerner, who was giving a hard time on the drill field and lunged at him with his bayonet and was given a year's suspension. So instead of graduating in 52, he graduated in 53. And he's a forgotten captain in the Pacific Northwest when the Civil War breaks out. But once the war explodes, he's serving in the Western Theater in Kentucky and Tennessee, and his rise is pretty, it's meteoric, to say the least. But he's in charge of the cavalry. This is a guy, you know, he's hard-headed. He wants results. He will not tolerate anyone who fails to bring them. And Custer, you know, is, you want me to jump? How high? You know, you got a dangerous mission? Give it to me and my Wolverines, that kind of thing. And one of the first things that Sheridan wants to do is cripple the Confederate cavalry. So he raids Richmond, Virginia, hoping to draw Jeb Stuart away from Robert E. Lee's army. This is May of 1864. And at the Battle of Yellow Tavern, Custer leads the charge that kills Stuart. And he's prominent other fights in and around Richmond. In August of 1864, Sheridan's put the charge in Union forces in the Shenandoah Valley, which has long been a thorn in the Union High Command's neck, place that the rebels used as an invasion corridor to repeatedly threaten Washington. And Custer reaches his apex as a soldier in the Shenandoah Valley, leads a cavalry charge that turns the rebel left flank, entrenched infantry at the Battle of Winchester. Cavalry rarely charged unbroken infantry. But Custer does that, and Sheridan is just so delighted, he gives him the command of the division, the 3rd Cavalry Division, which Custer will turn to the best cavalry formation in the Union Army. There are other victories in the Shenandoah. Confederate surprise Sheridan at Cedar Creek. Custer helps to stem the Union retreat there and then leads the attack and helps to break open the Confederate line and causes the rebels to flee. Sheridan will come out of the Shenandoah in early 65 and join Grant in front of Richmond and destroy a big chunk of Lee's army at a place called Five Forks. Once again, Custer is prominent there. And when Lee abandons Richmond and tries to flee west to get away from Grant and try and link up with Confederate forces in North Carolina, Custer is one of the point men in Sheridan's pursuit, helps to cut Lee's army in half at Sailor's Creek on April 6, 1865. And 2 days later, Lee is racing to reach a place called Appomattox Station, where trains are parked full of food for his famished army. Custer gets there first. Custer throws himself in front of Lee, checks Lee's retreat. The next morning, when Lee wakes up, there are tons of Yankees in front of him. You know, but Custer was the guy that pitched them off. Lee will surrender at Appomattox Courthouse. After the surrender, Phil Sheridan, I think, gave $20 in gold to Willa McLean for the table on which Grant had written the surrender terms for the Confederate Army. And he said, "Here, Custer, this is for you." And he wrote, "Well, it's for your wife." And he wrote a note saying, "You know, this is a present that I give you out of appreciation for the services of your gallant husband. No one did more to bring this about." He would say to Custer during the Civil War, "Custer, you're the only man who'll never fail me." So, you know, the movie shows a kind of a father-son relationship. This older guy sees some potential in this unruly cadet. But in actuality, it was a combat partnership. Sheridan, here's a dirty job. Custer, get this dirty job done.
Well, you mentioned never failing, and the impression that I got from the movie and even from what you were saying there is Custer was perfectly okay and seemed to enjoy taking a risk. But do they always work? I mean, it seemed like
he was a warm-up. He was a warm-up. He wrote, "When I think of the charges that were made, I cannot exclaim but glorious war." No, not always. The rebels weren't dumb. They were a capable enemy. There were times when he would try something and they would check him. But part of the reason for his success was that he thought and moved quickly. He's a cavalry commander, which is kind of like being a fighter pilot. You know, okay, they're on to me. I got a barrel roll out of here and then come around and try and catch him from the flank or the rear. So there were times when he got pushed back, but he rebounded. He just had that gift for it, and he had this tremendous relationship with the troops that followed him. They just adored him during the Civil War. He wore a red cravat, along with some other ostentatious garments, so that his men would always see where he was, especially when he was leading a charge. And the 3rd Cavalry Division, they all adapted red cravats. They call themselves the Red Tie Boys, you know, because we're Custer's. It stands in marked contrast to the relations he had with the 7th Cavalry on the Great Plains after the war. But he was leading, you know, these were volunteers who signed up to save the country. They wanted it done as quickly as possible. Any officer who would lead them in smashing the enemy and attaining that result as quickly as possible was okay in their books. That's Custer is one of these people, and you find them in different walks of life, who attains spectacular success while still a kid. Sometimes that can spoil somebody, because the rest of your life may not be as great as what you were doing at age 23 to 25. In some ways, I think Custer spent the rest of his life trying to reduplicate the success and the acclaim that he enjoyed during the Civil War.
Yeah. Well, you mentioned after the war, and if we go back to the movie, once Custer's out of the military for a short period after the war, but then he's reinstated to military active service and assigned to Fort Lincoln. And in the movie, there's a scene where, you know, while they're traveling there, he's traveling there with his wife, they're raided by the Sioux, and Custer manages to capture Crazy Horse, the Sioux chief. And maybe it's just me, but it seemed like that was a little too convenient the way that the movie portrayed that. they're at the fort, and Crazy Horse breaks out with the help of a friend. And then as a result, Custer shuts the bar down at the fort so the soldiers can't drink. He also shuts down the trading post that's selling rifles to the Native Americans. And we see a montage of Custer training the cavalry. How well did the movie do showing Custer's arrival and kind of whipping people into shape there at Fort Lincoln?
There's so much to unpack here. Let me begin by saying that Custer and the 7th Cavalry did not arrive at Fort Abraham Lincoln until 1873. So, you know, you've got 1873 that just gets skipped over. The Civil War ends. This large temporary army that had been raised to defeat the Confederacy is demobilized. Custer, at a temporary rank of major general by the war's end, reverts to his permanent rank of captain. Now, there was, he may have briefly considered leaving the army because Benito Juarez, who was fighting to drive the French and the Austrian puppet emperor out of Mexico, Maximilian, offered him command of the Mexican cavalry. But the army, the U.S. Army, would not give him a leave of absence. You know, if you take this post, then you're out in the army. Custer didn't want to separate from the army. Well, in 1866, while they're getting rid of all these citizen soldiers, they're reorganizing the regular permanent army. They expanded a bit, and they create four new cavalry regiments. We had the 1st through 6th during the Civil War, 1st through 6th U.S. Cavalry. Well, they now create the 7th through the 10th, and Custer becomes lieutenant colonel of the newly raised 7th Cavalry in 1866. And the guy who's, there are two people who serve as colonel during the rest of Custer's life. They're given desk jobs so that Custer is the acting commander of the 7th. And he starts out, he and his regiment start out fighting Indians, not up in the Dakotas, but in the southern plains in Kansas, the one is today Oklahoma. And he does not get off to a good start, because fighting Indians was a lot different than fighting Confederates who would form up and, you know, meet you face to face. Indians, if they saw a lot of white soldiers, they'd say, well, we've got a limited population. We're just going to leave these guys alone. We're going to melt away. We can, you know, our horses are quicker and we know where to hide. And we'll attack small detachments, and we'll attack stagecoach stations and things like that. So Custer's first summer on the plains, 1867, he is just going hither and yon. And the men he's leading, these aren't guys who had, you know, this definite mission. We've got to save the country. A lot of them were, I need a job. Being in the army is hard. Or if I join the army, I'll get a free trip out to the West that I can desert. I go to Colorado where there's silver and gold fields and things like that. So Custer has, he has this trouble with the 7th Cavalry there's a motivation problem. And as I say, he's got this desertion problem. A lot of the officers too, they're kind of surly because like Custer, they were all reduced in rank. Some went from brigadier general to captain. Custer was lucky going to lieutenant colonel. And they know this army's so small, it could be 20 years before I get promoted, et cetera. So why should I kill myself? But Custer's gotten home. We got to do this, got to do this. And he's pushing, pushing, pushing. And a lot of people decide they just don't like him. And he kind of reacts to those negative vibes. He becomes this really heartless martinet. I mean, you don't follow orders that I'm going to do, administer all kinds of punishments and things like that, tie you up by your thumbs, make you stand on a barrel. He ordered deserters shot without trial at one point when the problem got so chronic. And then finally, he suffers kind of breakdown. He deserts his own command to spend time with his wife. He hears that she's at a post where there might be a cholera epidemic and just goes bananas. And he's arrested and court-martialed, and found guilty, and suspended from rank and pay for a year, and returns to Monroe, to live out his probation. But other army commanders aren't doing any better against the Indians on the Southern Plains. And Phil Sheridan, who gets put in charge of the army in the West, he succeeds in shortening Custer's sentence by 2 months, and brings it back, and gives Custer a chance to redeem himself. And Custer will do that. He will lead a winter campaign in western Oklahoma, down into the Washington River Valley. He will attack a Cheyenne village at dawn on November 27th, 1868, kill most of the warriors, capture about 50 women and children. It's the Army's first victory over the Plains Indians since the end of the Civil War. So the Army, we really know what we're doing. And it establishes Custer's reputation, rightly or wrongly, because there were other officers who won more victories. But it establishes reputation as America's premier Indian fighter. And afterwards, he pursues different bands and resorts to diplomacy, talks their leaders into coming back to their agencies. Because he's a celebrity, rich people from the States and Great Britain come out and they want him to take them on buffalo hunts and things like that, which is a way of making for the Army, making points with American movers and shakers and good diplomacy with friendly powers. But while this is going on, the nation is in the thick of Reconstruction. After the Civil War, the radical Republicans tried to, implement regime change on the defeated Confederate states, more or less placed them under Republican state governments, supported by the votes of former slaves. And former Confederates resorted to widespread political terrorism to fight that. An estimated 50,000 politically active blacks will be murdered between 1865 and 1877. And things get so bad that Congress passes some what they call forced acts, which permits the inauguration of martial law in certain areas that are out of control, where the local sheriffs and judges either can't or won't try to control the Klan. So the 7th Cavalry from 1871 to 73, it's scattered to the South. An anti-terrorist duty, which Custer didn't like. He was a Democrat like his father, and he was kind of sympathetic to the former Confederates. But they're down there until 73. Then in 73, the problems are mounting now with the Lakota or the Sioux or the Northern Plains. And so the 7th Cavalry is sent to Fort Abraham Lincoln.
Yeah, that's very different. The impression I got from the movie was just like, oh, okay, the war's over, and so he's kind of waiting around until he gets something else. Yeah, well, as I was watching the movie, of course, this movie from 1941, and I couldn't help but get the sense that there was a racial side to this whole story that the movie doesn't really address. The closest that I saw the movie kind of admitting race as a driver of what the cavalry was doing was a bit of text. It says, and I'll read this off, is quote, "And so was born the immortal 7th U.S. Cavalry, which cleared the plains for a ruthlessly advancing civilization that spelled doom to the red race," end quote. And the way the movie explained what the 7th Cavalry was supposed to be doing was protecting, and I'll put that in quotes, some 100,000 square miles of territory. And it doesn't really mention this, but by protecting, they're really protecting the white settlers who are moving into Native American territory. So can you give a little more historical context around the role of the cavalry and the racial tensions of the time?
Yeah, you know, that phase of Custer's life is depicted, it's like the Battle of Hanover. It's Custer by himself and now saving the Union, and now it's Custer the 7th Cavalry protecting 100,000 square miles. Well, you know, there were a number of Army regiments out there on frontier duty, and of course, they were there to protect white interests, the interests of the United States government, the interests of certain stakeholders who had an important voice in the economy. And, you know, these are the people who would be the big donors, et cetera, especially the railroads. The Army, it's interesting. The Army will fight Indians if Indians leave their reservations, you know, if they break the rules. But a lot of Army officers are sympathetic to the Indians. So, you know, if these people were treated decently, they wouldn't go on the warpath, and we wouldn't have to go out and kill a bunch of them and also risk our own necks. Custer, in his autobiography, My Life on the Plains, which he published in 1974, I'm paraphrasing, but he said, if I were an Indian, I would far rather, you know, live the free life in the plains. I'd far rather resist than submit to life on a reservation where, you know, the government cheats you, doesn't give you food and other amenities, the other annuities that have been promised you in treaty. So there's, this contradiction there. But I mean, when Custer was told to fight, then fight he did. So, you know, I'm a conscientious objector. I want to sit this one out. The Army's job is to protect American interests. All of the movie, you know, they reach a point where Crazy Horse says, "We'll fight no more. We'll be good. All we ask is that you let us have the Black Hills." And Custer says, "Yes, okay, that's fine." And then the Indians are betrayed, right? You know, their final resistance that claims Custer's life. Custer doesn't blame them. In effect, you know, he sees that they're being exploited, they're being betrayed. After the war, the Army tried to open a road into western Montana where there were gold fields that led through lands that the Sioux considered theirs. And the Sioux under Red Cloud resisted that, and they ended up massacring an Army detachment of 80 men outside of Fort Phil Kearny. And the Army decided, gee, we just can't cope with these people. We don't have enough men. So they negotiated the Treaty of Fort Laramie, which more or less says that certain lands belong to the Sioux, and that would have included the Black Hills. So that basic agreement was made. But then in 1874, gold, at least the claims are made that there's gold in the Black Hills, and the gold rush opens up. And the person that was responsible for those claims was George Armstrong Custer. When the 7th Cavalry moved to Fort Lincoln, the first job was to protect a survey party from the Northern Pacific Railroad. So a big business interest is building across the northern part of the country to the Pacific Northwest. But the Indians are objecting and trying to stop them from deciding where to place the rails and bridges, et cetera. So the 7th Cavalry goes out in summer 73, and the Sioux oppose this expedition in force. Custer fights two engagements with the Sioux, and he's successful in driving them off. And I think that success caused him to believe, well, I understand the Lakota, I understand the Sioux, I know their bag of tricks. So they don't intimidate. And he may have paid for that 3 years later. But the Army is you know, thinks that the Lakota, you know, they were the most powerful coalition of Native peoples in the Northern Plains, that they're just, they need to be taken down a peg. So Custer set out in 74 to look for a site to establish a fort in the midst of Sioux country. There are geologists in this expedition, and the geologists claim that they found gold, and Custer writes an anonymous newspaper dispatch that says gold is to be found at the very grassroots. You know, it's right on top. You have to dig deep. Now, the country had plunged into a major depression in 1873. So the cries of gold, you know, elicit a massive response. They would have anyway. Initially, the Army is used to try to intercept these people who are trespassing on Sioux land. The Army's used as peacekeepers, but they're just so many. And the interlopers are white. And if they can't vote because they're living out of established states, they got friends and relatives who want to make sure they're safe. And in the end, the Grant administration decides to force the Sioux into war. In the winter of 1875-76, an ultimatum set out saying that any Native people, so Lakota and also their allies, Cheyenne, who are off their reservations by a certain date, they will be considered hostile. In other words, the Army will have permission to kill them. And this ultimatum set out so late in the year that it can't even reach these villages before the deadline expires. So they set up this thing, and we have the Great Sioux War of 1876-1877 as a result. And the Army organizes three columns, converging columns, come at the Indians from three different directions at once. Hopefully one or more will bump into Indians. The Dakota Column, mainly the 7th Cavalry and some other troops, under Lieutenant Colonel George Armstrong Custer. The Montana Column under Colonel John Gibbon, and then the Wyoming Column coming out of the south under Brigadier General George Crook. So that's set up. But Custer gets into trouble. He loses command of the Dakota Column, which gets alluded to in the movie.
From what you were saying, it sounds like the movie fabricated basically that. The impression I got from the movie was that Custer was blameless in breaking this treaty. Like there's a scene where I think he's on a train and he's heading back to Washington, and he realizes, oh, what's going on? That, oh, there's this gold has been found. He realized it was going to happen, and he tries to expose the plan, but nobody listens to him. And, you know, he ends up seeming pretty blameless. I think the name of the Sharps, like a father son, you know, business that we're trying to push this to keep their business. They were the ones that were running the trading post.
And this plot line would appeal to Americans who have come through the Great Depression, right? Because who do you blame for the Great Depression? All those stinking selfish capitalists that destroyed the economy, right? So the bad guys aren't going to be Custer. It's going to be these business guys who are willing to sacrifice people, you know, lure these people into the Black Hills where they'll be murdered by the Indians just so they can create more business opportunities for themselves.
According to the movie, Custer's career is kind of in jeopardy there, and he makes a plea to now President Grant to try to get reinstated and try to join his regiment to fight the Sioux on what's looking to be a suicide mission. Is the movie right to imply that Custer knew that he was going to die at Little Bighorn, but he still went out of his way to try to make sure that he would be there with his men?
Custer didn't have a suicide wish. What happens is that Custer, he sticks his nose into politics when he shouldn't. He's a Democrat, and that's one reason why he remained a lieutenant colonel for the last 10 years of his life. That was part of it. But the Grant administration, listen, since Grant administration, you know, it's famous for widespread corruption. President Grant himself, there's no evidence he was dishonest, but he had a bad habit of appointing people to high office cabinet posts who turned out to be crooks. And his Secretary of War, Belknap, is in trouble because he was in charge of awarding post-sutlerships, you know, the Sharps store, where the chimps could buy liquor and other things. Well, there was corruption there. And, you know, if you paid Secretary Belknap a certain premium and then gave kickbacks, you'd get that contract. And the troops were told you could only shop in these stores. You can't go into nearby Bismarck and get things, you know, at a cheaper price. And because these crooked sutlers were, you know, paying extra money to get their licenses, they were hiking their prices. So Belknap's being investigated. There's a congressional probe. It was known as the Clymer Commission. And Custer is heard saying some things about this corruption. And so he gets subpoenaed to do it on the record. And so he is criticizing the Grant administration. I mean, Grant was honest, but he stood by dishonest trends longer than he should have. You know, instead of going after them, he'd go after the whistleblowers. But Custer also implicated his brother, Orville Grant, in some of these dealings. So he's not only sullying the reputation of Grant's administration, but he's also going after a member of Grant's family. So Grant says, Custer can't go after the suit. You know, put him under arrest. He moved. And that creates something of a furor. The Democrat press, of course, says he's persecuting a soldier. And letters are going to the West, to the White House. How can you keep Custer, our greatest Indian fighter, out of what's going to be the biggest Indian war ever? Custer's department commander, Alfred Terry, intercedes on Custer's behalf. Sheridan does to a certain extent. And Custer writes a letter to Grant. He doesn't burst into the White House, but he sends Grant a letter that pretty much expresses what Errol Flynn says to Grant in the movie. He said, you know, spare me the humiliation of seeing my regiment ride out against the enemy and me not to share their privations and dangers. And so Grant says, okay, he can go, but not in command. Terry, you got to leave your comfortable headquarters in St. Paul. You're in charge of the Dakota Column and make sure you keep Custer on a tight leash. And so Custer goes in a second in command of that expedition under General Terry.
Okay. Okay. A letter makes a lot more sense than in the movie. We see Custer basically walking into the Oval Office and
it's like punching out a superior officer. It's exciting filmmaking perhaps, but no, yeah.
Well, in the movie, we don't really see Custer dying at Little Bighorn, but it's definitely talked about, and it's clear that he does, along with everyone in his command. And as I was watching the movie, the thing that came to mind was how we saw Davy Crockett keep fighting until the end of the 1955 Disney movie, you know, King of the Wild Frontier. This time it's Custer who seems to be the last one alive while everyone around him is dying. How well did the movie do showing Custer's last stand?
Well, you know, again, it simplifies things. I mean, Custer and his entire regiment go riding around, then they see the Indians, they go right toward them, and then they realize, boy, they're a heck of a lot of Indians, so we better get off our horses, just kind of form a shapeless mob and shoot at the Indians and die fighting. In reality, Custer, with about 650 soldiers, scouts, they are following a trail. Starting on June 22nd, that will eventually lead down to the Little Bighorn Valley. The faulty intelligence available to the Army inclines Custer to believe, in fact, he tells his officers, on the night of the 22nd, we can expect 800 to 1,000 Indians, and surely our regiment can handle that net. But the trail gets wider as they follow it, because more Indians are coming in and joining Sitting Bull and Crazy Horse. But it leads a little bit more, and Custer decides, well, you know, he had separated from Terry. Terry's coming down from the north. He's supposed to be swinging Custer south of the Indians. You know, I'll wait a day. I'll wait till the morning of the 26th and attack the Indians then. That will give Terry time to come in from the north with five troops of cavalry and about seven companies of infantry and two Gatling guns. On the morning of the 25th, he is informed that his regiment has been spotted by some Sioux who were just out, you know, probably hunting or something like that. And he says, well, they're going to ride to the village and they're going to inform their friends that there are a lot of white soldiers. And what the Indians do when there are a lot of white soldiers is that they take off. You know, we don't want to suffer heavy casualties, even though we have a chance of winning. We want to, live to fight another day and do it on terms of our choosing. So he rides into the valley of the Bighorn. He has 12 companies of cavalry. He sends three companies to the south to make sure the Indians aren't trying to escape in that direction. And then one of his interpreters sees about 40 Indians riding away from Custer's column. They approach and says, "There go your Indians running like devils." So Custer orders Major Marcus Rito and three companies to cross the river and charge the village, wherever it is. Not quite sure, but they're in that area somewhere. So cross the river, head north, and when you see Indians, charge them. And then Custer, instead of following Rito, he will swing north on the other side of Little Bighorn, the east side of Little Bighorn. And people think, well, he was just trying to find a way to flank the Indians. But everything falls apart. Rito runs into tons of Lakota and Cheyenne warriors who are not in the mood to run. They reach this point, these people, they were pushed around so much that they thought, this is our last year of freedom. This is our last year where we can be real Indians. Instead of run away to fighting it another day, the battle cry is, it's a good day to die. If you got to go out like a real Indian. And also, the whites had surprised them. Those Indians that had spotted Custer's regiment early on didn't report back to the village. So there's this village with thousands of women and children. And these Indians, we're not going to let these white soldiers hurt our loved ones. We're going to let them out. So they rout Reno, and they kill about a quarter of his men. He's able to, by leading a panicky retreat, get to the other side of the river. Custer, though, has continued northward. And we're not exactly sure what he tried to do. He probably tried to stay on the offensive too long. He was hoping that Captain Benteen would come up with the reserve ammunition and send a couple of couriers to Benteen, but Benteen didn't move that quickly. And in the course of a two-hour engagement, Custer and his five companies are whittled down by Indians fighting from cover, not riding around in circles like, look what a good target I am, shoot me, white man. They're sniping. And then they'll overrun. Segments of Custer's command, but they destroy Custer and the 210 officers and men under his command. Custer is found at the top of a hogback ridge, which was probably one of the last positions that the soldiers held. And they found he had army issue rifle, he had a Remington hunting rifle. They found some cartridges from that rifle under his body, so he was alive when he got there. How long he remained alive, we don't know. We don't know who the last was to fall. The Indians weren't standing up, so who could I identify, making good targets of themselves? They wouldn't have known him anyway if they'd seen him, especially since he'd been up in the field and had a beard, he's covered with dust, etc. He was probably, probably lasted most of the battle before he went down. He was hit with a bullet in, I believe, the breast, and one in the temple. Either one of them, one could have killed him.
Something that I saw in the movie that kind of threw me off a little bit, because one of the first things that we see Custer do is to tell his men to fight on foot. But then earlier in the movie, he had said that, the cavalry has a much better chance than the infantry. So why would the cavalry just immediately get off their horses? Doesn't that basically...
Who knows? It's a cavalry job. So here's the Indians, will be infantry. And again, they're not deployed in any military formation. They're just this mass. And they're all firing at once. I mean, they're guys close to Custer. And this circle was like maybe 20 guys deep. So how do you miss the guys that are between you and the Indians while you're blazing away? What we do know from the archaeological evidence is that in certain places, Custer's troopers formed skirmish lines. These were open order lines and blazed away at the Indians until those positions were compromised and overrun. But yeah, I mean, it's a cavalry job because cavalry has a better chance of pursuing and catching mounted Indians. But the Indians don't run away. So he knows they're not running away according to the script scenario. They're there for their last stand. So yeah, there's a disconnect there between what the script says and military tactics.
According to General Sheridan in the movie, if it weren't for Custer's 7th Cavalry sacrificing themselves, then Terry's force would have been wiped out, the squatters massacred, and the entire frontier overrun. And as for Custer himself, he sent a letter, a dying man's declaration that proves the whole peace treaty conspiracy was true. Tape is forced to resign and the company is dissolved and so on. How well does the movie do showing the aftermath of Custer's death?
Pure fiction. The 7th Cavalry lost about 265 personnel killed at the Little Bighorn. So there were people killed in addition to the 210 men who died with Custer. Most of the other dead were with Reno. Indian casualties were dead, at least, were about at least 50. But, I mean, it wasn't like the Indians suffered. It wasn't a fear of victory for them. What happened afterwards, though, was that the Indians decided, we can't feed this mass of people if we stay together. You know, there were no 7-Elevens out there. You had to hunt your own food. And so they will break away. They will splinter. And that will make it easier for the army, which will flood the area with troops, to hunt them down. The Grant administration and the business interests that the Grant administration was serving, they're not held responsible. Well, I mean, Grant is because he's president, but the main reaction was avenge Custer. You know, the Indians, get the Indians. They're there. You kill those savages, you know, Sitting Bull and all his friends. So, the Indians, their victory enhances their status as targets. And the army will keep after them. Crook and Terry chase after them with not that much success, but other abler commanders like Nelson Miles. And they'll keep doing it in the wintertime, which is rough on the Indians because their horses, their ponies are grass-fed. When snow and ice covers the grass, which if there's any grass left at the end of the summer, it's burned out. It's not that nutritious. They really can't. They can't feed them. I mean, wintertime is when they kind of hole up and they live off the dried buffalo meat that they've gathered in the warmer months, etc. But they're not allowed to do that because the soldiers are after them. The buffalo coats, as they call them, they're just tramping through the winter wastes, and so these Indians. They either get tracked down and attacked, and then the survivors surrender, or other people say, you know, our kids are dying. Our old people are dying. We can't keep this up. Better to live on the reservation than to watch the slow death of our families. Sitting Bull flees into Canada, and he'll come back later to live on a reservation. Even Crazy Horse ends up surrendering, and then he's killed in altercation. He gets a bayonet through a kidney because the army thinks he's plotting a revolt. So these people are beaten into the ground. So Anthony Quinn maybe wasn't as dramatic as he conveyed it, but yeah, it was. You know, Custer's defeat was also ensured the conquest of those Indian patriots.
Well, the movie doesn't really mention this, but I was always under the impression that it was Custer's wife who kind of helped secure his legacy after death. What you're saying here almost sounds like there may have been some other parts of it too, as far as the military is concerned.
She will write 3 books about their life together in the West. And in those books, he is the 19th century American of a knight errant. He's good, gallant, brave. His motives are always the purest. He's a considerate and loving husband, all things. And just being in his presence is a pleasure. I mean, you get some glimpses of Victorian sexuality. She'll talk about narrow waists and broad shoulders and things like that. So she dug his butt with them crossing their private correspondence. They had a pretty healthy sex life, but yeah, Libby will become his press agent. And so the customer you see and they die with their boots on, that's her vision of George Armstrong Custer. She also went after the two senior officers of the 7th Cavalry, Major Reno and Captain Benteen, claiming that they deliberately abandoned her husband, that they would help his rescue, and the Army will hold a court of inquiry in which those officers will be found, will be cleared. But it's interesting, within a few years, each one gets kicked out of the Army on morals charges. Reno is accused of being a peeping Tom looking through the window at his colonel's daughter as she's getting dressed. And Benteen was accused of getting drunk and exposing himself to urinate outside of a sutler's store. So, you know, it's, I get this sense that the Army just waited until no one was looking at it to kind of handle the situation.
Yeah, especially what you're saying. I mean, granted, a different scenario, but what you're saying earlier when Custer was at West Point, he's having a lot of things just kind of shoved under the rug. But then here it sounds like, okay, well, now we could come up with excuses to get rid of some people, almost the opposite.
Yeah, well, you know, it's an institution. Whether someone's right or wrong, if having them around causes trouble, then you get rid of them. You know, certain people are sacrificed for the institution's needs.
The movie seems to make a point to mention a song called Gary Owen. Was that actually a song that the 7th Cavalry performed like we see them doing in the movie?
Definitely. Gary Owen was an Irish drinking song. It originated in the 1780s. I think Gary Owen is a suburb of Dublin. It's about, you know, just going out getting drunk and beating people up, smashing windows, having, you know, instead of spawn, eating water, we'll drink brown ale, pay the reckoning on the nail. But it was a rocking tune, and it became popular with Wellington's British regiments during the Napoleonic Wars. And it pops up then on in the band books of Union Army regimental bands during the Civil War. So Custer undoubtedly heard it during the Civil War. It's interesting, during the Civil War, his fighting song was Yankee Doodle. One of his officers wrote, whenever our old brigade band sounded Yankee Doodle, every man's hand went to his saber, because it was always a signal for a charge. But he picks a new one for the 7th Cavalry. And when he won his first big Indian victory at the Battle of Washington, attacking at dawn, he had the 7th Cavalry Regimental Band with him. And to signal the charge, the bugle blowing the charge, the bandmaster was told, sound Gary Owen. And so they're playing Gary Owen on his brass instruments. They didn't play that much of it because the bandsman's saliva froze. But they got enough notes out to get the attack going. And Arthur Penn in Little Big Band will show a fife and drum band playing Gary Owen when Custer attacks the Indians at the Washington.
Today, we are talking about a movie that was made in 1941, but if a movie about Custer was made today in 2022, what do you think some of the differences would be in how his life is portrayed?
Well, you know, there would be greater consciousness regarding the Indian Simon story. In the early 1990s, I think 1991, ABC did a two-part miniseries called Son of the Morning Star, which was based on a best-selling book by Evan Cannell. And that movie attempted to, well, it's sympathetic to the Indians. It's sympathetic to the Indians. Custer, in fact, comes across as kind of a surly kind of guy, just driven by his ambition, does care a bit about his family, is in love with his wife, etc. But he's not as attractive a character as the other being lead, Crazy Horse, played by Rodney A. Grant. And I imagine that even today, if a film was made about the Little Bighorn or about Custer's life, Custer wouldn't fare as well as some Indian figures, which is too bad, because there were two sides to it. There were people who were willing to go to their death with him, and there were other people, again, the 7th Cavalry. You read memoirs and diaries and letters, about half the people who serve under him love him and half hate him. And being able to try to capture him and find an actor who could show you both sides of a man who could inspire those diametrically opposed reactions That would be a challenge for a scriptwriter, and that would be a challenge for an actor.
Well, let's say that you were in charge of that. What would be one of the things that you would leave? Like, what would be one of the things that you would change about that?
Well, as I said, I would try to see if we could if we could capture that that seeming contradiction kind of thing. But also, Custer's an Indian fighter. That's how he's cast. But he also fought for Indians. The Lakota, one reason they were powerful was because they were able to take land and resources from their neighbors. And the whites, whenever they went into battle, they had a large number of Indians fighting on their side, the tribes that had been vanquished by the Indians they were fighting. I mean, they were able to constantly do a kind of divide and conquer strategy throughout the Indian Wars. But when Custer goes into the Valley of the Little Bighorn, he has 35 Indian scouts. And their job is not just to say, look, there are other Indians, they're going to fight. Most of them were Arikara or Rees, as the whites called them, and the others were Crow. And it's interesting, the land on which the Battle of Little Bighorn was fought, that was traditionally Crow territory. In fact, today, that's the Crow Agency. They have these big Custer's Last Stand reenactments each year, and they bring in white cavalry reenactors, and they use local Indian talent. The local Indian talent, though, are the descendants of the Indians who fought on Custer's side. But in the reenactment, they're playing the Sioux because it's good business. Okay. Trying to bring in that kind of subtlety, there's this, it's not just white versus red. I think that would be helpful as well.
A more complex story.
Yeah, a more complex story.
Thank you so much for coming on to chat about They Died With Their Boots On. For someone listening to this who wants to learn more about your work, can you share a bit about your books and where they can get them?
This film, as much as anything, is the reason why I became a historian. And so it's no coincidence that my first book, Custer Victorious, The Civil War Battles of General George Armstrong Custer, that was my first book. I didn't see that very well, but because I had this Custer fascination, and it's still a trip, still selling. In paperbacks, people can buy it at Amazon.com or wherever else books are sold. Done other books about Custer that are out of print, but I, kind of maintained this interest in Last Stands. It's one of the things that led me to Wake Island. I wrote a couple of books about the Marine stand at Wake in 1941. The one about the battle is called Facing Fearful Odds. And it's kind of interesting because the script for Wake Island resembles They Died With Their Boots On. At the end, the Marines are all showing, fighting to the death. And they're being wiped out by hordes of Japanese, just like Custer the Seventh were wiped out by hordes of Lakota. And the movies were, cast that way to, inspire patriotism and, inspire Americans to, step forward, put on your country's uniform and make the sacrifices necessary for victory. In fact, The Guy With Their Boots On came out, 1934, 7 years after the book that turned Custer's image inside out was published. Frederick Vanderwaal published a book called Glory On, which depicted Custer as unprincipled, ambition-driven, self-absorbed villain who was willing to sacrifice friend or foe to move up in rank, to get more attention, etc. And that book was a bestseller, and it was affecting the way people looked at Custer. But when Warner Brothers decided to make this movie, they said, well, we got a war coming on. It would be unpatriotic, to make any Army officer look that bad. So the Libby Custer version was presented to the public in that film, and it helped to perpetuate for a while the positive vision of Custer, but that would soon fade in the 50s and the 60s.
I like the comparison that you made of Wake Island, which, of course, we talked about that movie too, which came out, I think Wake Island came out in 1942, right? Which would have been, right after this. So very heavy on, both very heavy on the propaganda side with World War II.
And Americans willingly sacrificing themselves to buy time so that their countrymen will be ready to prevail. So yeah, that's this last stand theme. It's been a powerful current in Western literature going back to the Song of Rome. And I imagine, we still see that. We see films about doomed outposts or patrols in Afghanistan or Iraq. And it's, there's still that last stand quality.
Well, thank you again so much for your time and chatting about this. I had a lot of fun.
Same here. Always a pleasure. Always a pleasure.
This episode of Based on a True Story was produced by me, Dan Lefebvre. I'd like to thank Gregory J.W. Irwin for sharing his expertise about the historical accuracy of 1941's They Died With Their Boots On. If you want to learn more about Custer, I would highly recommend Gregory's book called Custer Victorious, The Civil War Battles of General George Armstrong Custer. And don't forget, you can hear more from Gregory in a couple previous episodes of Based on a True Story when he joined us to chat about the movie Wake Island, as well as the movie Glory. Okay, now it's time for the answer to our two truths and a lie game from the beginning of the episode. And as a refresher, here are the two truths and one lie. Number one, Custer's promotion to general during the Civil War came as a surprise. Number two, Custer was not a model student at West Point. Number three, Custer commanded the 7th Cavalry during the Civil War. Did you find out which one is a lie? Let's start with number one. Custer's promotion to general during the Civil War came as a surprise. That's true. Gregory explained that the movie was correct to suggest that Custer's promotion to general came as a surprise to him and many others. But he also pointed out the movie was wrong to suggest that it was an accident. Let's bounce around a bit to get to number three next. Custer commanded the 7th Cavalry during the Civil War. That's the lie. As we learned, during the Civil War, there was the 1st through 6th Cavalry, but it wasn't until after the war that the 7th through 10th Cavalry was raised, and Custer was given the command of the 7th. That means number two is also true. Custer was not a model student at West Point. Gregory told us that Custer basically believed there were two positions worth having in class, first place or last place. And since he wasn't inclined to work hard enough to attain the top of the class, he tried to stay as close to the bottom of the class as he could without being kicked out. In fact, as Gregory pointed out, Custer admitted that he was not a role model during his career at West Point. Last but not least, it's time now to let you know how long it took to create this episode. If you're a longtime listener to the podcast, you'll know that I like to share this information just to help you appreciate all the podcasts that you listen to. After all, a huge majority of podcasts out there are like mine, completely free to listen to, but that does not mean they're free to create. Quite the opposite. They can cost quite a bit of money, and almost every podcast out there has higher costs than money. They have high costs in time. The time it takes to learn the technical side, to research the episodes, to record them, to edit them, and so on. But I only have the stats for my own show, so with that in mind, today's episode took me 39 hours to create. To make it clear, that's only my time. Gregory has spent years researching and gathering his expertise, so obviously it does not include any of that time. And to be a little more specific, even that time of mine doesn't even include all of my time, because that 39 hours is only the time that it took for me to produce this one episode. It doesn't include all the time that I spend building and maintaining the Based on a True Story website, finding new guests, and scheduling, and the logistics of all that, the email newsletter, social media, and all those things that don't have anything to do with making today's episode, but are still things that are required to make the podcast overall. In a nutshell, this podcast may be free to listen to, but it's not free to create. And that's why I'm so thankful for the sponsors whose ads you've heard on this episode. You can find more about them over at basedonatruestorypodcast.com/advertisers. But they're not the only ones helping to keep the show alive. There are wonderful people just like you who are helping to keep this show financially going. So if you found value in today's episode, and if you're using a Podcast 2.0 app, I'd really appreciate it if you boost now. Otherwise, I hope you enjoyed today's episode enough to share it with a friend, and maybe even consider helping to support the next episode over at basedonatruestorypodcast.com/support. Once again, that's basedonatruestorypodcast.com/support. Until next time, thanks so much for listening, and I'll chat with you again really soon.